This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 59. And today, very excited, a wonderful conversation with Dr. Rhea Almeida on her new book, Liberation-Based Healing Practices. And we're just going to get right into it. So the Black Lives Matter movement, LGBTQ removed from the armed services, Tarana Burke spiriting the hashtag MeToo movement, walls that imprison and walls that keep others out. These are the issues that renowned family therapist, sought-after lecturer, activist Dr. Rhea Almeida tackles in her new book, Liberation-Based Healing Practices, published by the Institute for Family Services. Meticulously researched and fluently written, Liberation-Based Healing Practices synthesizes more than 20 years of research, community practice, and engagement. On each page, Dr. Almeida breathes new life into the spaces of psychology, family therapy, and the allied disciplines of psychology. Born into the Desi Indian and African diaspora, Dr. Almeida was diagnosed with polio as a young child. Raised in Uganda, she and her family were forced to flee to the United States when dictator Idi Amin came to power. Her experience as a woman of color with a disability, along with the mentors who influenced her, has shaped the strategies and tools she developed to shift the foundation of critical consciousness to one of empowerment and accountability. Dr. Almeida's liberation-based healing perspective has become a gold standard for therapists and individuals worldwide and links people across family and community boundaries. Through case studies with step-by-step solutions to engender healing, she exposes the therapeutic norms of Western societies and how they are entangled with practices and histories of coloniality, too often anchored within individual pathologies, creating a paradigm-shifting roadmap that leads to genuine healing. So let's find out more about this great work with Dr. Rhea Almeida right now. All right. Welcome to the show, Rhea.
Yes, thank you.
I'm glad to have you here. And I'm excited about your new book titled Liberation-Based Healing Practices. And thank you for getting me a copy. And thank you for signing it. I want to just say this. I really appreciate signed books. I like collect them. So
that's great.
Yeah, thank you for that. So, okay. But to get started, and I will link, listeners, I will link access to the book. So, and you should all get it. But yeah. But to get started, can you just tell our listeners a bit about your background and the context that you work in currently?
Yes, sure. So I, like many, many therapists out there, started off in following my family therapy postgraduate training at Ackerman. Actually, I was working teaching at Rutgers and then working in a mental health facility, and very quickly found that the ideas that I was thinking about and the way that mental health was being conducted was not really moving in a space where I thought people were actually developing their multiple identities and accessing different aspects of their resilience, but they were sort of just being trafficked along a symptom-based problem. Mm. And so shortly thereafter, when I worked at an inpatient, I was actually the director for an inpatient center, and they were shocking people. This was in the late 1980s, mid-1980s, they were shocking people, not only the elderly who clearly may have needed some electric shock treatment, but actually young kids, adolescents, because they had a 28-day cycle to get the kids out of there. Wow. And so that determined my faith, and I decided that I could not work in a system that did not inquire the treatment protocols and for who it was used and for what the intent was. We were just blindly following the insurance policies that said to us, get the kids out in 28 days. So that's when I started the Institute. And I essentially started it because I was teaching at Rutgers at the time and involved in some domestic violence work. And there were some people in the area around Rutgers, who were mostly upper middle class, who actually did not want to go to the police, did not want to get involved with the criminal justice system, but they wanted to be seen as a couple. And that was when I first kind of wandered into this area of thinking, okay, I'm interested in working with them, but I do know what the standards say, and that you can't really work with couples when there's domestic violence. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I got in touch with several, actually off-duty policemen and some school people, school personnel, and asked if they would sort of partner with me to work with some of these men, and I would see the women separately. And really, that's how it started. It started from, you know, I had read Freire back then, I knew his work in critical consciousness. Hmm. And so I started by bringing these people into the therapeutic context and beginning to have these conversations. And that's where that idea then sort of completely ballooned into looking at critical consciousness as a really important foundation for bringing people together. And what it actually did, which is I didn't really know that that would be the outcome, but having, I'm just talking about cisgender violence right now, having other men present actually interrupted the physical violence immediately. Because the introduction of men who did not support that was a really strong incentive. Mm. So that's where it kind of began. And I, through the years, have kind of changed and morphed based on what the clients tell us and have moved it from that very small population of domestic violence to really working with all kinds of clients and expanding that whole perspective of building critical consciousness with clients.
That's great.
And that's what we do.
Okay. Do you still teach? Do you still?
I don't teach at Rutgers anymore. No.
Okay.
No. I mean, I teach at our center. We have a postgraduate training center.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So in your new book, you start by, and we'll talk about critical consciousness in a bit, but I wanted to maybe start by laying out kind of the essential concepts of liberation-based healing. Mm-hmm. And you start with the difference between colonialism and coloniality. And I wonder if you could take us kind of through those and the differences and some of the other essential concepts.
Yeah, thank you for asking that question, because that's a really important conceptual structural definition that oftentimes gets lost. Mm. So when we think about colonialism, we think, well, we know what colonialism is, right? And then we know what post-colonialism is. And so here's where the departure of coloniality and post-colonialism begins. So the authors of post-colonialism really believed, and some do believe today, that we were beyond colonialism, that the empire ended overseas, you know, slavery was ended here, Jim Crow was done, and now we were in a post-colonial phase and trying to figure out how to manage the new structures and how to manage sort of bringing back social justice after we'd gone through colonialism. But as as the authors and a lot of scholars looked at the whole notion of post-colonialism, it was very clear that for many communities, post-colonialism never happened, not only here, but overseas as well. So for example, here, being in really modernity, because we moved from colonialism to modernity, we never moved to post-colonialism. And stop me at any point if you want me to explain anything more.
Sure.
And so what became coined as the particular time phase we're in is coloniality, because it actually defines a space between modernity and sort of liberation, with post-colonialism never actually having happened. And the idea of postmodernism is an idea that occurred for many Europeans, many European cultures, and many scholars that bend towards white privilege, who actually did not pay attention to the fact that for many families and communities, it was not postmodernism. People are still stuck in modernity. And just to give you concrete examples, for example, if you look at the prison industrial system, if you look at the health system, look at the mental health system, you look at all of the ways in which, you know, the water system for people, not only in this country, but wherever we were, had held an empire, are still as awful and life-destroying as they were during colonialism. So you have to ask the question, like, how have we moved from that space? Like, what's the time engine that tells us we've actually moved from that colonialism period to postmodernism, because we really haven't. Mm-hmm. And so the distinguishing framework is coloniality, that frames that space from colonialism to modernity, with the idea that we'll hopefully move from modernity to a place where we can actually challenge what's going on right now, whether it's education, like I said, the prison industrial system, healthcare, whatever right. space of lived experiences you look at, we're in some trajectory of coloniality.
Yeah, and you reminded me, because I have read some of your other writings, and you have been critical of postmodern therapy approaches, I think, in mm-hmm. some of your writing. And I wonder if you could say something about that.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you know, some of the, I won't go into the artistic and music postmodern criticism, because there's a lot of really great work there
sure.
in terms of the critiques of postmodernism with art, dance, and literature. But in the therapeutic field, I think it's fair to say we can think of the narrative approach as a postmodern perspective. That's what they talk about, post-structuralism, postmodernism.
Right.
And if you look at the narrative approach, just as an example, it's an ahistorical approach. It does not look at history. It looks at the particular person in the context, problematizing the person's current experience. And then, of course, co-authoring and writing people's experience to kind of change whatever it is the person was stuck in or embedded in. It's individual because it's not based on family or community. Hmm. It's purely an individual perspective that brings witnessing in. I know that Michael White brought witnessing in specifically, for example, if there were eating disorder people or if there were youth that were being bullied. Right. But it's not a systemic witnessing that goes on continuously, so that you have a client, let's say, that was in Sarajevo or someplace in a war-torn space that has a community that's constantly carrying them through the wounds and healing them. It's kind of a one-time thing. So that's been most of my critique of it, that it's really not it's talked about as a systemic piece, but it really is not when you begin to dismantle it. And the other critique is that it's filled with language and writers who are brilliant in terms of writing. Most people who are doing work on the ground can't really author something the ways in which some of the narrative people author stuff as they're co-authoring stuff with their clients. So those are just a few pieces. The other concern I have is that approach has kind of landed, and there's been a lot of critique about it, mostly in spaces and countries in Africa and South Asia, because they land in as the anthropologist, they study the event, and then they write about it. So when you interrogate that, we have to think about how different that is from anthropology that's been really critiqued in terms of how we went in, whether it's Margaret Mead or other anthropologists that went in and studied cultures, wrote about it, and then left. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. Yeah. And I appreciate that. And it's nice having kind of another perspective, because we do talk to a lot of narrative and postmodern folks on this show. So I'm going to maybe move into critical consciousness now. In the book, you say liberation-based healing builds on the foundations of critical consciousness, empowerment, and accountability. And I'm wondering if you could take us through those foundations.
Yes. So with the idea of critical consciousness, now you probably know that critical consciousness is a platform that's being used widely in educational systems, like teaching kids from, you know, pre-K to high school. It's being used in many systems. In some higher academic systems, it's being used because the idea is that the norms of education, the way we've had them, which are the liberal norms, have to be moved if we're going to go from a curriculum-based instead of static knowledge-based to a base that actually has inquiry and dialogue mm-hmm. built into it. And so correlating that with the norms of therapy, you know, we pretty much know the conversations around therapy evolve around what the presenting problem is, right?
Right.
What is your problem? What brings you into therapy? And
exactly.
So based on who the therapist and what the foundation, the philosophical orientation of the therapist is, it may be broader or narrower, but the societal and contextual factors that are real and really in people's lived experiences are not consistently explored or interrogated. So if we have an undocumented person coming in today, or even a few years ago, we talk about the trauma of being undocumented and what that means, but there's not a larger sort of lens, if you will, on, you know, what does undocumented mean today, given the way that we as the United States have interrupted so many democracies in Latin America, created havoc there, and that even this recent migration is a long extended reaction to what's happened, right?
For sure. Yep.
And so having those conversations actually creates a sense of empowerment and allows people to begin to think beyond the place where they're being damaged and traumatized every day mm-hmm. with the presenting issue or the presenting identity of being undocumented. And it goes for even a young, you know, black man, brown man who comes in, who's, you know, in the incarceration trajectory. It's like, do we focus on that or do we focus on that and the history of Jim Crow and what that means so that the kid that's coming in is not just caught up between when he got arrested, what he got arrested for, how can we give him a plan to, you know, change his trajectory, but actually giving him the ability to think about what it means in a larger perspective. And that process really moves people to a different perspective because now they're not sort of just caught up with that one identity where they're being traumatized or they're being arrested, but they see all of the other ways in which they have a historical identity that could be garnered to help heal the position they're in.
That's great. Yeah. But you talk about accountability as well and empowerment. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, so empowerment, again, in the mental health literature, which has some great sources, is really about, you know, leading the voice, the experience, and really the emotionality of the person who's been, you know, harmed, hurt, you know, discarded, marginalized, whatever. And it's usually focused on the person, right? And it focuses on advocacy, like how do you talk to, let's say, a young man who was just recently fired, when actually there was nothing in his work history that would have documented that. You know, how do you deal with a woman, let's say, who's pretty high up in the corporate world and who's been downsized because, you know, she was challenging of a white male boss, let's say. Typically, you would empower that person individually, right? You would talk to them, you might give them some strategies. But when you look at empowerment in a larger context, you have other community people who can speak to that person's experience, who can all lend their voice and actually their experience to giving her the strength to mobilize that system. So it's not just the individual therapist and that person, but a whole circle of people. And that circle of empowerment is a lot more powerful just in terms of what happens with clients as outcomes than working with a person individually.
Do you do things like that at the Institute? Do you kind of bring in, I guess, witnesses is a language I would use, but I don't know if...
Well, we call them actually healing circles because our clients are there every week witnessing.
Okay.
So they're there. So, for example, if we recently had a woman who is... she's Latina and she's really... She's language challenged and her daughter has been in actually a pretty good school system, but the kid definitely has learning disabilities. And what the school has done is given her accommodations, but without giving her an IEP. And they keep telling the mother how helpful they are. And so finally we've had, you know, because we have teachers in our circle, we have parents in our circle that have had to deal with schools in other ways. So first we talk about the structure of academic of education in schools so that the parent who's facing the particular challenge can look at the larger systemic analysis and see that this is not an individual interruption of her daughter's right to a fair education, that it's a larger systemic issue. And so from that, what can we do and how can these other people help her advocate with the school system? And so from that particular experience, you know, people wrote a letter for her to the superintendent and to the principal demanding an IEP and had the language and the facility to do that. She got, within 10 days, she got an IEP set up.
That's great. Yeah. And accountability. How do you do accountability?
Yeah. So accountability is, you know, again, I think this is such a, this is an amazing time to be talking about these ideas because our current climate, we find ourselves right in more than ever calls for accountability.
Right.
We're a society that I think comfortably feels comfortable about saying sorry and moving on. But this does not serve well in terms of building character in kids or adults or creating some kind of a moral spine for people who have harmed or hurt other people. And so, like, just for example, with bullying, right? When you think about bullying, it has three parts to it, like the power analysis, the patterned repetition, and then the intent. And the intent piece is usually what educational systems use to try to correct that situation. But that's the least effective because it's hard to sort of interrogate intent.
Sure.
But if you look at power and you look at the patterned repetition, you can pretty much document what's going on and then create accountability between the kid that's bullying other kids that are bullying and the kids who are being bullied in a space where then there's a larger circle of conversation, because the whole book talks about the idea of just doing it one-to-one has no social capital delivered to other people who may be witnesses, may be watching it, but don't have the experience to join that conversation. And so it doesn't kind of migrate through the whole educational system because you limit it to this very narrow individual sort of space.
Got it.
And really, I think this largest college scam, which, you know, is just like totally unbelievable. So even that talks to you about what the hierarchy is like. Not having power talked about in therapeutic conversations, I think, leaves people out of that knowledge space, which is what coloniality talks about. Like, we know about it as therapists, but what's our explanation for not inducting our clients or sharing that level of knowledge with our clients, who can then make their own decisions?
That's great. Yeah. Okay. In the book, you provide strategies of liberatory healing through decolonizing. And I wonder if you could kind of take us through some of these strategies. And I could maybe name some of them, kind of starting with transparency and the naming of structures of dominance and redrawing the boundaries of inclusion, something I'm really curious about, epistemic disobedience, and defining empowerment in the collective rather than the individual terms, all wonderful strategies. I wonder if you could say more about them.
Yes. So transparency and the naming of the structures of dominance really begins, again, with our building critical consciousness. Because, again, to reflect on therapeutic practices, people come in, right, with a presenting problem. But we don't start off, the person comes in and they're mildly depressed or they're, you know, depressed because they got fired, let's say. We focus on the depression. We focus on how they can sort of, you know, go back to normalcy, but we don't give them the language and the structure of dominance. So we don't actually, we do it through film and through a lot of the tools that we use. You know, we have in the book the whole hierarchy that actually shows the trajectory of power. And that information, believe it or not, is something most people don't think about because of the individually driven paradigm and the individually defined structure of, you know, this society and many Western societies. People often think that their problems are sort of invented by themselves, or they own their own problems.
Right, right.
So the minute you kind of open it up and you show them the structures, that's the transparency piece, because we may have, you know, conversations around the coffee clutch talking about how, of course we know why she was fired, you know, because of this, this, and this. Of course she's depressed. But that knowledge and that conversation never gets threaded into the therapeutic context. When in fact, that is the healing piece, because if that person knows that she may have been fired for, you know, challenging a white boss or challenging a male boss and feels bad about it, but then she realizes how much it's a larger social pattern, and we can have movies that actually take people away from the immediate situation and can have these dialogues and then realize, oh, you know, that is really similar to what I experienced. So first of all, it changes their internalization and their emotional reaction. It changes the sense of depression that they feel immediately, because now it's kind of exposed and it's out there and it's not internalized.
Yeah, and it connects them to others in some way as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it shows that there's a larger system that they individually can't battle. They can battle it as a group, and they can do things with that individual structure knowing it. But now they know it's not that they personally totally responsible for what happened. And redrawing the boundaries of inclusion kind of follows that in terms of, so most mental health systems and most family therapy training centers, right, have senior clinicians, junior clinicians, and then interns, right?
Right.
And then the interns at most mental health facilities, for example, and even at family therapy training programs, will see the Medicare, Medicaid, and the low-income paying clients. And then the higher the faculty will see private insurance people, the higher paying clients.
Right.
And so that's really how the trajectory goes. But when you start to think about, all right, so what if we did not separate that? And we said anybody who comes to the center will be seen by all of the faculty. They won't be that kind of bifurcation of who has the money and the insurance and who doesn't. So that immediately interrupts that process. Hmm. And so now we're mixing class, gender, race, GLBT folk in the same space, defining the boundaries, really defining the boundaries of segregation. It's never labeled as segregation, but it is. It really is segregation, because you go to any mental health system, you can look at the, you know, you look at all of their stats, and you basically see who's being served by which of the people on the teams.
Right.
And so people always say about that. Well, do you think that you know, somebody who's making, you know, who's the CEO is going to want to sit with somebody who's a sanitation worker? Why would they do that? Hmm. And a lot of people, you know, Robert J. Green is one of the researchers that interviewed a lot of our clients. And a lot of them said to him that, and especially a lot of the upper class white men said to him, well, I wouldn't have thought that before, but the experience I learned was something that gave me a life experience that I would never have otherwise had. And it just keeps me coming back again. You know, besides the fact that being in that circle, they felt that they could actually provide, not only get stuff for themselves, but give stuff back in a way that they'd never thought about, because they'd always thought about getting stuff to keep themselves afloat.
Sure.
But the idea that they could get and give back in a very mixed space, they had never thought about that. And they mostly, many of them would consider themselves liberal and think that they would want diversity in schools, they would want diversity for their families. But of course, they're living in segregated communities. So there's, unless they're doing something in terms of a, you know, volunteerism, they're not really going to be in those spaces that puts them in a desegregated space.
True. Now, epistemic disobedience. Can you say more about that?
Yes. Epistemic disobedience is a concept that's written a lot about by Walter Mignolo. And he's a coloniality scholar. And what he talks about is that we're all socialized, whether we're mental health providers or, you know, educators, whoever we are in the space of coloniality, we're all socialized to do things a certain way. And the sort of, you know, covert message is that you don't disrupt that hierarchy. You just go along with it. Whether you're a teacher in the school, you know, you might disrupt it a little, but you understand what the hierarchy is. And what he says is in that hierarchy is, of course, the hidden dimensions of oppression and authority and control, which we never get to. So even doing something like having clients in a space like this, where we're not putting them in there based on their diagnostic categories, we're not putting them there based on the fact that they are either paying a certain amount or not paying something, so that epistemic disobedience is a way in which we're disrupting the whole hierarchy of mental health, that although mental health is there to heal, it has these hidden spaces that people don't interrogate that actually collude with the oppression.
Right. And work against the healing.
And work against the healing. Exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Talk about defining the empowerment in the collective rather than individual terms. Please.
Right. So the collective is really what I was saying earlier in our conversation, that having a single person try to advocate for themselves based on whatever coaching you're giving them is a lot less powerful and helpful to the person than actually embracing them in a circle where they have many people to draw from. And it's the whole circle that's embracing them as they're going from having this thing happen to them and then getting to the place where they can actually challenge it or, you know, find a way to move away from it. And so that collective is very powerful because not only does it offer empowerment in a very different way, but it also challenges the notion again that, you know, the individual paradigm is really a difficult thing to do. It's very difficult if you're a single parent, whether you're a woman or a man, as a single parent, it's very difficult to go up against a school alone.
Right.
I mean, if you have the money, you might hire an attorney or hire, you know, an advocate, but or going up against a CEO in a corporation, it's a difficult thing. Being a teacher in a school, going up against the principal is a hard thing. But if you're in a circle, you have so many ideas, and then you have people that can accompany you to that, in that process, it changes the way in which you feel you're carrying the load on your back.
Yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a bit, about how you might pull together these kind of healing circles that you have. But before we get there, in the book, you're critical of multiculturalism and cultural competency as an otherizing scholarship that supports or centers whiteness. And I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
Yeah, now in full transparency, I will say that I myself have contributed to cultural competency chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And I have gone myself through an evolution when realizing with other scholars who are critical of this scholarship, that in fact, what happened is the ethnic studies evolved right after the civil rights movement. And after the civil rights movement, they were supposed to make a decision about having access to different forms of options. I believe it was education at that point. And so many of the civil rights people and the ethnicity studies came together, and I'll send you the link to it. There was a particular judicial hearing where they said, okay, why don't we just separate the ethnic groups so that we can be sure that certain people who have different levels of access will have more levels of access. So there was a law actually codified at that time that then evolved into ethnic studies. And then ethnic studies, which tried to actually bring knowledge to white people about cultures that ethnic groups that existed outside of the main white stream.
Right.
And then that moved into mental health as being the place where, of course, if we understand these different ethnicities, we can empower them, we can speak on behalf of them, and we can actually bring to the forefront what they embrace and what's important to them. So in doing that, you know, the secondary casualty, if you will, is that we created homogeneous borders or boundaries around ethnic groups. So when you think about whether it's South Asians or African Americans or Latinas, it's like they're a homogeneous group as if there's no trajectory
right.
That group. As if it's that some people in that group may not even identify in that way. You know, it has then created textbooks with writings, for example, in a very well-known textbook that's used in social work a lot, there's a South Asian chapter where the author says to the student is seeing a couple, and the couple is basically saying to her that they don't want, the daughter-in-law does not want the mother-in-law to live with them. She's pregnant. She doesn't want the mother-in-law to live with them. And the husband says, well, you know, in our culture, it's very important that my mother lives with us because otherwise it would affect me and my role as a husband. And the author says to the student, you do have to respect that culture. In that culture, it's believed that men should be the head of the household. And when you look at that systematically, you can actually do a read with many of the cultures, many of the textbooks. They're not all that like that, but most of them are. Let's maintain the norms of that particular culture without actually challenging any of it. And sure. Without actually saying that has nothing to do with culture. That's patriarchy.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you look at all of that, and we're now, what, 30, 40 years into cultural competency, nothing has changed. Because it's only now in the last 5 to 7 years where there's one chapter on white privilege. Okay, so the idea that there was a scholarship that never fundamentally challenged white supremacy as the foundation for why all this was going on is flawed.
Right, for sure.
So it gave white people a pass because, you know, if you throw money to Latinos and African Americans and they think they have their own thing going, meantime, you're creating a divide between them because everybody's fighting for those dollars.
Yeah.
Right.
And you stay in the center, or we stay in the center.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's a lot more. I mean, I'll send you the article on cultural, the critique that I wrote.
Yeah, that would be great. And I can link it in the show notes, please. I know our listeners are going to be interested, but what might be some of the ways our listeners can build on a critical consciousness, and what role might it play in therapy?
So I think that the role in therapy is really important. Well, let me just back up first and say that the therapist needing to be critical conscious is as important as the client, because most of the training in mental health, you know, the mythology of education gets conflated with a higher consciousness and a knowing of the process of accountability, when in fact, people graduating, whether it's in medicine or mental health, there are structural barriers that define, right, the social determinants of health related to even to mental health.
Right.
But most doctors and their ways of communicating to clients from border spaces communicate to them in very different ways than they do with clients that are from a mainstream perspective. So there's a lot of work being doing with doctors in terms of teaching them communicating such styles, teaching them how to use language that's accessible to people in border spaces. So those doctors need to be critically conscious. And the same thing, I think, happens for mental health providers. We all go through graduate work and we're taught about the symptoms and the problems in the schools, but we're never taught to interrogate our own biases, our own hidden structural sort of transactional connections to oppression that get maintained because we think we're doing a liberal thing and we're entering a field that has a lot of positives in terms of being able to take a culture and do what's good, right?
Sure.
But if we've never interrogated those faces, I mean, we've had so many students come in and actually be shocked that they either had privilege, or students who come in and think that they may actually, because they've really never done any of their own work, that they might in some way harm some of the clients. And while they're actually harming the clients, don't think about that, you know, at all. So I think that that notion of critical consciousness is really important. And it happens through being able to not just read a curriculum for what it is, but actually unpacking that curriculum in terms of what the meaning and the structure is that you're delivering. So you can be talking about, you know, I don't know what it means to be healthy, let's say, and there's a curriculum with the nutritionist and, you know, exercising every day. If you don't look at that curriculum and talk about, okay, so how can our clients do the exercise that's being laid out here? Does everybody have access to a gym? Who are the clients we're talking about?
Right.
Do all these clients have access to the kind of food that this nutritionist says that they have to get?
Right.
Like, that's critical thinking, in that you're going to actually then really connect to the clients you're working with and begin to modulate that curriculum that you thought was something that was so good, but you never thought about who is it really good for.
Exactly. Yeah. Great example. But for, like, do you suggest reading, or how would you suggest?
So I think that reading is one thing, but you know, like Paulo Freire always said, critical consciousness doesn't happen with me and me alone. The process of dialogue and community is what creates critical consciousness. So if you're not dialoguing with somebody about what you read, let's say you decided you're going to read a chapter from a book and you're going to discuss it, if that discussion doesn't happen, then that ability to rethink and reflect doesn't happen with you alone. So we suggest to people when we're doing trainings is get a people of 4 to 6, get together in a circle of 4 to 6. And then do some of the readings in that 4 to 6, whether it is around, you know, structural racism, health, whatever.
Right.
But do it in a circle, because it's that circle that creates the components of, you know, reflection, dialogue, and inquiry, which is what you need. Because if you don't have dialogue, reflection, and inquiry, you're not building critical thinking.
That's great.
Critical consciousness.
That's great. And it's a nice segue into my next question, where in the book, you make the case for redefining and expanding the therapeutic context, and doing this by inviting community healers and activists to engage in and to expand the circle of healing. You have a chapter on, I think, creating circles of healing. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about that, how you do that at the Institute, or how you would suggest our listeners, if they were interested in creating new circles of healing, how they might go about doing that.
Yeah, that's a great question, because people oftentimes, when they see the work, they get a little overwhelmed.
Sure.
But they forget that we took, you know, we started with a very small circle. We started with 4 to 6.
Okay.
So I always say to people, start small. Don't think you have to get 20 people in a room. Just, you know, everybody that's doing, whether they're practicing in a mental health system or alone, they're seeing at least 6 to 10 clients, right?
Mm-hmm.
So get those 6 to 10 clients in a circle, whoever you're seeing, get them into a circle, and then start having these conversations about the outer societal norms and processes, whether you use films, you know, whether it's Love and Basketball, whether it's, you know, Hope, the Black Panther, whether it's, you know, Don't Bother, Sorry to Bother You, which is great. I mean, any movie, bring the clip in with those 6 to 10 people, and you'll be amazed the conversations that it sparks. Because through that, what you will get is conversations about class, about economics, about race, about health. All those conversations come out because now they're not talking about themselves personally. So it does several things. One is it refocuses the path from what the emotional experience or trauma that they're kind of stuck in, and it moves it to the larger conversation where they can then see sort of threads of their identity to these different conversations they're having.
That's great.
And then you building the interest of wanting to move on and having, you know, further conversations. You can do it through music with our the kid circles we have. We do a lot of music and a lot of spoken word and poetry.
That's great.
You know, like we use Malala, for example, as having kids think about somebody that can do something in a place where nobody would have expected that, because a lot of kids sometimes feel really worn down with what they have to deal with.
Sure.
And seeing that is really an inspiring story, and having dialogue around that, you know, changes their neurology, it changes their brain function, but it also gives them options.
That's great. Okay. One quick way you did, going back to the transparency about naming structures and dominance.
Mm-hmm.
Now you said you don't explicitly kind of do that. You prefer to do it through art and music or kind of other ways, or that's your preference?
So we start off with the movie clips, right? So, you know, if we were doing a movie about somebody at work who's being dominated, we would show a movie about about that. And I've got examples in the book. And so you talk about the movie, like any of some of Michael Moore's movies are great to talk about corporate greed.
Yeah, capitalism. Yeah.
The movie, right? And you talk about corporate greed, you talk about the institution, and then you log their institution, and you have them name the people in that hierarchy and where they fit in that hierarchy. So now what you've done is you've named the global systems, and now you've named their particular system. And they see where that particular system fits in. And that in itself is building critical thinking, but it also is a way of relieving their anxiety, because like I said earlier, it is amazing when people see that larger conversation, because the majority of people don't think about that. They don't think in those larger social constructs. And then they see how their personal story is connected. Their little hierarchy and their little corporation is connected to that massive social corporation.
Yeah.
So we are naming those structures, you know, whether it's our drinking water, whether it is in Newark, we just had all this horrible stuff with the water, which they'd hidden for years. These kids have now been drinking water with lead for years in Newark. And so again, when people have that sort of, when those structures are made transparent, they can say things like, okay, when I go to the grocery store and I buy this food, I need to look at the labels. I need to know where it's coming from, because it's not just me, my food, and my family. It's, you know, what stuff is in there that's going to kill my family? Because now we've made transparent the structures that will harm them, even though not directly.
Got it. Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, it did, and I appreciate that. Thank you. As we end, I guess maybe for our listeners, because like you stated earlier, even currently now, there's always something new coming at us, and I'm wondering, what are some of the ways that want to pick up this work? What are some of the ways they can resist and thrive and stay woke on the path?
A lot of ways that can happen, again, is to really, you know, keep that conversation open. And I think what's really helpful is that in our circles, for example, we have people of different political leanings. And many new people that come in, if the older people will talk about a conversation, or if we're showing a news flash, they won't talk about their political leanings. And, you know, we don't ask them to. And then in time, they'll say things like, oh, I'm so glad I was here and I talked about this because, you know, I don't talk to half of my family because of this, because we can't have conversations. But I can see how we can have conversations here. So let me just give you an example. There's a woman who's actually, she was born in this country. Her parents came from Ecuador. They were actually smuggled in a car to get here because the mother was almost killed by a gang. Mm. And so this young woman is very successful, you know, in her 30s, has two kids, says that she thinks we should not be letting any more people across the border because, you know, if we let people across the border, of course, they'll come and, you know, there's only so many resources we have. So we have to stop it. So instead of ending that conversation there, the conversation grows, right? Like, so what do you know about our resources? Like, where did you learn about them? The next session, we'll, you know, talk about the resources, have her do her research, have other people do their research about this notion that there's only, you know, a depleting source of resources. And, you know, what is she reading? So you come to find out that she's only listening to Fox News and that she has no idea about all of the resources and the taxations and everything else that's going on. So she sees that and she's actually shocked at how she considers herself really woke and knows a lot of stuff and how she was completely complicit with not having that knowledge. And so it gives them the sense that they can, that idea of resisting, is you really resisting this larger move to separate people, right? And to be divided by these really thorny, horrible issues,
right,
that they can come together, and that thriving really is a matter of beginning to celebrate what people have. Like, even if you're in the worst space, if you're only focused on the pain and the trauma and you don't have a circle, you don't have somebody you can celebrate what you have, then we're colluding with the larger system that says, let's stay focused on that part of your identity that's being harmed and destroyed, because the more we stay focused on that, the more you will eventually be destroyed.
Wow. Yeah.
And the, you know, the staying woke, I mean, again, bringing stuff in like that young woman from Sweden who just created this National Day of Resistance yesterday.
Yeah. The climate change. Yeah.
Yeah. Greta, I can't remember her last name. I mean, the kid is phenomenal.
Right.
You know, so it's like being aware of stories like that, that most people are not. Most people don't hear those stories. That's what keeps people pushing and enthusiastic and willing to take the fight on while feeling great about it. And I want to say one more thing about that idea of resisting. We have a few people that are on antidepressants because they, you know, have been really severely traumatized, some veterans that are on antidepressants. But for the most part, people will come because we don't automatically use a psychiatrist when clients come in. And most people come in what they define as depression. Within 6 to 8 weeks, they're not depressed. Hmm. It's literally released. And I think that's a finding that's really significant, because it does move them to the place where if they're focused on the larger piece, it creates an anxiety. It does create an excitement. It brings them together. They're having conversations about issues and spaces that actually invigorate them. And even though there may be some harm in that, they're looking at how they can shift it and yet celebrate what they have that they brought with them in spite of the forces that have tried to bury them.
Right. What sustains you in the work? Yeah.
Well, being with these circles, it's really, actually one of our students was talking to us last night and saying she always felt like working sometimes with really difficult clients or even just doing clinical practice all day is exhausting. And that what she's come to see is the fact that we debrief every night. We're a team of therapists, so we're rotating in and out of the circles. It's not one person. The clients are not owned by one therapist.
Right, okay.
The whole team owns the clients, and we'll sort of have that relationship. And the clients know that. It's consent. And she said, I realize I leave here, and I'm not exhausted. I want to stay and talk more because it's really exciting work, and I don't feel like I have something hard in my chest, which I usually feel, which I felt in my last placement.
Hmm.
So that's what keeps me awake. It's exciting work to see people come from spaces that most would people usually think that would be the end of their lives, to see them thrive is just really, really rewarding and inspiring.
That's great.
And to see people with power and privilege really be willing to give it up and share, which I think is one of the fundamental aspects of healing, is they're willing to share with those people who don't have that much or who have nothing. And that, to me, speaks to the power of human grace.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for that. Okay. Final question. I know people will be interested. I will be linking the book on the show notes, but if people want to reach out to you, how do they find you? And I know you have a conference coming up that you'll be at. Can you say maybe something about that as well?
Right. I'll send you the link to the Perfect. Conference. It's actually being it's being hosted by Medgar Evers this year.
Great.
In the city. So we're very excited about that. And the concept of the conference, of course, was to travel it around to bring this knowledge to different places, especially spaces where people may not have access to this information. So,
and just so they know, that the title of the conference is
liberation-based healing conference.
That's it. Thank you.
So it's at Medgar Evers this year, and people can contact me at the institute, which is We Care For You at IFS.
Great, and I'll link that as well.
Yeah.
And okay. Well, we'll have all the links on the show notes. And, and Ray, I just want to congratulations again on the new book. Everybody, you should go get it. And I just want to say thank you for taking the time to share your experience with us. It's very much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Great. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
All right. That's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. You can find The Radical Therapist on all the social medias, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Just go find us and friend us. We'd appreciate that. Please share this episode widely with all your friends and colleagues that you know need to hear it. And if you're going to be in Denver on around Denver on April 27th, I will be presenting at the Denver POMO Gathering on Rupture and Repair on the Therapeutic Relationship. And then the following weekend, I'll be in Vancouver at the Vancouver School of Narrative Therapy Conference, where I will be presenting with my colleague, Dr. Justine D'Arrigo-Petrick, on something titled Beyond Deconstruction. Come find out what that's all about that first weekend. I think it's May 1st through 4th in Vancouver. And it would be great to see you. If you're going to be at any of those places, reach out to me, let me know. It'd be nice to just connect and meet up and all that kind of stuff. So that's our show. Find us on social media, share widely, come visit. So that's it. As always, my name is Dr. Chris Hoff. This has been the Radical Therapist Podcast. Thanks for listening.